John Horgan is a professor of psychology at Georgia State University and is an expert in terrorism. He has previously advised the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit and was appointed to its Research Advisory Board. He grew up in Ireland when the IRA was still active in the country, and his experience with terrorism is both personal and professional. I was lucky enough to talk to him on the anniversary of 9/11. Here's our conversation. And okay, I think we're ready. So I am here with Dr. John Horgan, a professor of global studies and psychology at Georgia State University. Dr. Horgan, thanks so much for joining me today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
The reason I got interested in you is I had heard that much of your job, or at least a lot of your research work, you're interviewing terrorists or former terrorists. I know you're going in there as an academic, but on a human level, what is that like? I mean, do you ever find yourself judging these people or empathizing with them in any way?
That's a great question. Lots of things go through your mind, yeah. To say the least. Empathy is a difficult one. Sometimes people, I think, confuse empathy with sympathy. It is important to listen to what they have to say. It's important, in as much as it's realistic, to try to put yourself in that person's shoes, to get a sense of how they see the world and how they try to explain what they do. But I think there's a fine line between trying to understand that and trying to listen carefully to their account without necessarily sympathizing with them. It can be challenging because I think even the most well-meaning of researchers will, you know, myself included, we'll all have our biases, we'll all have our preconceived ideas about how the world is, and it can be difficult to place that aside. You introduced me as someone who interviews terrorists. I wish I could do more of it. I mean, it's still relatively rare, even within my field, and that is because there's a wide range of pretty complicated issues that go into trying to arrange these interviews. We don't, as a research community, we don't do it nearly enough, and it's because it's largely quite challenging to do. But it is possible, and they will meet with us. For the most part, it's former terrorists. It's people who they've gotten involved, they've done things, they have, again, for the most part, they have been apprehended, arrested, they've served some time, and then they tend to make themselves available to researchers. But it's
well, why is it? I can imagine, I guess, certain challenges with that, but is it challenging legally, or do these people not want to generally talk to academics?
Believe it or not, it tends to be the opposite. People tend to be quite cooperative and facilitative. Now, that's not to say that they don't necessarily have some kind of agenda. I mean, my agenda is, as a researcher, is to get you to talk to me because I want to learn about it and I want to write about it and teach about it. If a person is, for example, disillusioned and is on the path to rehabilitation, 9 times out of 10 they want to talk because they want to share their story. They want to show the world that they are genuine and sincere about this new pathway that they are on. But you know, we're just as likely to get access to people who still are deeply wedded and committed to those radical beliefs. And so, you know, from their perspective, they might be trying to use a researcher as nothing more than a platform for propaganda. So as a researcher, you have to be really careful about whether or if and how you are being used.
That's an interesting point, because when that happens, I mean, is that an obvious sign that someone who's deeply committed is using you, or I mean, what preventative techniques do you have for that?
They're not necessarily aware that you know they are using a researcher, and very often a researcher isn't necessarily aware that he or she is being used. I mean, when I was 20 years ago, when I was a graduate student starting off with this, I would interview IRA members of the Irish Republican Army. in Ireland, where I'm from, I thought at the time that I was getting very good interviews simply because these guys were sitting down with me and talking to me. But it was only afterwards I realized that it was all propaganda. They would spend time answering my questions with reference to history and politics, and you know, because I didn't really know what I was doing at the time, I couldn't really see that it was really more propaganda than anything psychologically based.
Interesting. And so is there, you talked about IRA, Islamic terrorism, is there anything that sort of inspires these people across groups or movements?
For sure, yeah. I mean, I think for years and years and years, we tended to assume that the person who joins a group like the IRA is fundamentally different to the person who goes and joins Al-Qaeda or ISIS. I think the more, the better the research gets and the more researchers we see coming into the field, the more we're seeing that the similarities are outweighing the differences. When we're fundamentally talking about people who are driven and fueled by some moral outrage. They see some injustice in the world, and their view is, by my actions, by my violent actions, I am helping to make the world a better place. So that is one of several features that really unifies what on the surface might seem to be very, very, very different kinds of people and groups.
So in your experience, these people are not necessarily pathological or mentally ill, although I'm sure there's some overlap there.
Oh, for sure. And you're always going to have exceptions. You're always going to have people who are outliers within these groups who will display what would appear to be psychopathic or sociopathic tendencies. They tend to be the exception rather than the rule because, by and large, psychopathy doesn't explain involvement in terrorism. And especially when it comes to thinking about, let's say, terrorist groups and organizations, they tend to be fairly good at screening out would appear to be a little bit odd and unusual. When I first started studying this, I had the other assumption. I thought, well, surely being a psychopath would prepare you well for life in a terrorist group. And it turns out it's actually not the case at all.
Well, why is that?
Well, because psychopaths are driven by personal motivations. I mean, it's only ever about them and nobody else. To be an effective terrorist, you have to be able to willingly put yourself in danger for what you believe is a cause that is greater than yourself. And that is fundamentally incompatible with the psychology of the psychopath.
So, in other words, that sounds like a kind of a common human trait where it's almost, you know, idealism.
For sure. So you know, here's what I would say. Don't assume that the terrorist is motivated by anything other than the things that drive all the rest of us. I mean, we all look around, you know, and those of us that are socially conscious and socially aware will see injustice. The difference is the terrorist comes to realize one way or another that the only way to remedy that injustice is to commit violence against bystanders or non-combatants.
Wow. How much of terrorism is, or people who become terrorists, are people who, for lack of a better word, are just kind of losers, or people who have nothing going on in their lives and who this gives them sort of an escape or like a grand narrative that they can piece together what their life means?
So that's an interesting question. I wouldn't equate being a so-called loser with looking for something. I mean, you see all different kinds of people, not just across the spectrum of terrorist groups, but even within one individual group. You know, so there are some terrorism specialists who will really focus on one movement or one type of movement. And you'll have others who will, you know, try to see or look for patterns across the gamut. But even within specific groups, you'll have people who are some are what we could call genuine losers. They have failed at everything that they put their minds to, And they might view them, they might view their involvement in terrorism as almost a kind of revenge. I mean, a way to push back against a society that person has viewed as failing it, or him or her. Many people who join terrorist groups will at least tell you that they are trying to, as I said earlier, they're trying to make the world a better place. Now, that might be something that they tell themselves to convince themselves about the righteousness of what they've done. It can be very, very difficult to disentangle what initially pushed a person down that pathway to the kinds of things that they themselves later then use to justify their behavior. Because people change. People change as a result of being in these groups. They might initially walk the walk in terms of expressing a willingness to do things in these groups or as on behalf of these groups, but it's only after a while do they start to acquire a way to justify to themselves and others what exactly they've done. So in a way, the ideology often comes later on. But people join for all different kinds of reasons. Some are true believers. They really do buy into the ideology. They buy into the notion that the only way to right this wrong is to engage in acts of horrific violence against non-combatants. Others get involved because, as you said, they're bored out of their minds. They have nothing going on, and it can be really challenging when you have an older sibling who decides that he wants to go off to Syria, and what do you do? You're left to stay at home and look after a younger sibling or parents or whatever it might be. So very often the kinds of things that will initially pull somebody into terrorism are little more than adventure seeking, camaraderie, excitement, a sense of adventure, a sense that just something better awaits you out there. And afterwards, that's when someone might get ideological. The real challenge is when I, as a researcher, catch up with that person years later and try to get a sense of what motivated them to get involved. We get this mishmash of different kinds of factors, and it's really, really, really hard to figure out, okay, well, but what happened first? What's the sequence of events that led to you going down this pathway? That's our task as researchers.
You said that a lot of the people you talk to are people who no longer believe in the ideology and want to disengage. Is that a common feature of people who join terrorist groups? I mean, what a lot of
hard to say if it's hard to say if it's really common, because I think it's easy to overgeneralize based on if disillusioned terrorists are the ones that are speaking to me as a researcher, then, I might easily assume that all terrorists are disillusioned and fed up with the ideology. So I think, we need to be very careful about overgeneralizing based on the ones that, we select to talk to us. I think, again, it varies. I think most people who join terrorist groups will become disillusioned at some point or another. For some, it can be a trigger to, convincing them to disengage, because very often when fantasy and reality don't match, the first reaction is, I'm not entirely sure what I've signed up for here, but yeah, maybe I need to get out, and I need to get out now. Others struggle with it, and they try to cope with it. They try to convince themselves that, well, I've given up my family, I'm on the run, I'm here. I might not like it, but it's a matter of sunk costs. So I've got to see it through no matter what happens. It can be very, very hard work psychologically and in other senses to live and function as a member of a terrorist organization. But it's my hypothesis that everyone who joins a terrorist group will become disillusioned at one point or another. The issue is, some people will acquiesce and cope with it, and others will struggle, and they might become ineffective.
So we're going to release this tomorrow, which is going to be the anniversary of 9/11. Did we overreact to 9/11?
Yes, we did. Yeah. There's no question we did. And that is common. I mean, for those of us who study the history of terrorism, The strategy of terrorism is about getting us to overreact. It is about poking and prodding us and humiliating us into thinking that we are helpless in protecting our own civilians. That is the psychological warfare that terrorism is based on. And it is about trying to provoke that overreaction. I mean, this is essentially, as has been characterized before, the war of the flea. It's about looking 1,000 times more powerful than you actually are. It's often in our overreaction to terrorism that we inadvertently generate sympathy for terrorists, and you know, more often than not, we make the problem a lot worse.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'd read that terrorism increased over 7 times in the region after the invasion of Iraq. There's been some U.S. generals who said drone strikes create more terrorism than they kill. Do you feel that the use of force has backfired in any way in terms of quenching terrorism?
No, it hasn't. I mean, you know, in some cases, I mean, the use of force would seem to be the only viable option, particularly when there are training camps and there are select operatives that otherwise cannot be reached. That said, very often those who advocate for the use of force tend to see it as a panacea, a one-size-fits-all solution to the terrorism problem. And as has been said again many, many times before, we cannot either capture or kill our way out of the terrorism problem. So I think very often, and this is not to lay the blame at anyone other than terrorist organizations, of course, but we talk ourselves into problems here by assuming that a complex problem like terrorism can have a simple solution. It is... disheartening to me that 18 years after 9/11, we still talk about torture as if it's effective and useful, and whereas it's not only not effective, it is counterproductive. And so we tend to just fall back on rather limited assumptions and biases about what works. And I think we've got a long way to go to figure out that we need far smarter approaches to this.
Could you explain why torture is counterproductive?
Well, torture, experts on torture, people who have studied cases of it, former investigators at agencies like the Naval Criminal Intelligence Service, would say that torture has never produced reliable information. Yet we have this pervasive myth through Hollywood, through politicians, through high-ranking counterterrorism officials, that it implicitly works, and that is a very, very dangerous assumption. And one of the greatest assets we can have in fighting terrorism is to essentially take the higher ground and maintain moral superiority in the way that we tackle this problem. Very often, all the torture does is simply feed the narrative that we are an enemy that needs attacking in the first place.
Is that because if you're being tortured, you'll basically just say anything to stop?
Oh, for sure. Yes. I mean, I should have said that at the outset. But I mean, who among us wouldn't say anything to make torture stop? And I think what has been especially troubling has been this gradual erosion of norms over the years, and this idea that waterboard isn't really torture because there isn't lasting physical damage. I mean, it's really quite shocking just how far we have slided in over the years.
The term terrorism itself has come under some scrutiny because it's defined as being non-state actors using violence to achieve some political or ideological end. Correct me if I'm wrong about that.
That's largely correct. I mean, again, people who study terrorism would say, well, the general meaning of terrorism is that it is associated with non-state groups that are trying to overthrow or otherwise destabilize some regime or ruling power. But state terrorism is also a phenomenon that is studied. But for the most part, when people just use the word terrorism in general conversation, it tends to refer to non-state actors.
There was recently the terror attack in El Paso. Have you spent any time on white nationalist terror groups?
A little bit, yes. I mean, I have spent some time interviewing former white nationalists and looking at their accounts of engagement and disengagement. Make no mistake about it. I mean, we are riding a wave of extreme right-wing nationalism and terrorism, not just nationally, but worldwide right now. We're seeing a major resurgence.
And what motivates those people? Similar things as we've talked about?
Well, similar sorts of things. They see themselves as a community under threat. They look at as some of the big social changes that we have seen largely as a result of conflict. We're seeing the mass migration of refugees. We're seeing people fleeing conflict worldwide. And right-wing communities view their communities as being under threat. And so when we hear, you know, politicians talk about invasion, for example, it certainly fuels that narrative that they see themselves as under fire, under threat from some external force. It's the same kind of not just conspiracy, but it's the same kind of defensive rhetoric that is then used to explain proactive acts of violence against those targets. The similarities will always outweigh the differences. And so, you know, we have, it's unusual, I mean, as someone who studies terrorism, but, you know, we see these siloed characterizations of domestic versus international, or extreme right wing versus Islamic or whatever, or Islamist or whatever, you know, phrase you want to use. But the strategy and psychology of terrorism remains the same the world over.
On that same point, what when it comes to online recruiting, that's been talked about a lot. Do you see any similarities between groups like ISIS and, you know, white nationalist groups?
Yeah, so the research on online recruitment specifically is a little bit in its infancy. We know that these groups have a very, very large online footprint, and certainly from a propaganda point of view, and as a platform for showcasing, in some cases now live streaming, these horrific acts of violence. There is no doubt that social media has allowed these groups to grossly magnify their influence and their impact, essentially. Where things are less clear is how those groups have used the internet to recruit people. There are some signs that people have been identified and groomed online. But for the most part, it tends to be in real world social networks, for want of a better phrase, that really is the sort of the impetus for recruitment. The use of the internet and social media has become so ubiquitous in modern life that it's kind of increasingly hard to tell where one begins and one ends. But it is unquestionably a defining feature of modern day radicalization and involvement in terrorism. It's easier to see the effect of online propaganda when it comes to propagating and sustaining radical extremist beliefs. It's much, much, much harder to understand where the acquisition and commitment to those beliefs ends and incitement to actual violence that results in real world engagement begins.
When people talk about lone wolf terrorists, people who just get radicalized, like online, for example, and then go off on their own and commit an act of violence, is there any real way of preventing that, or do we just have to accept a certain level of risk?
Well, I can give you a few different answers to that question. We're always going to have to accept a certain level of risk. Now, there, you know, that shouldn't be seen as fatalistic in any way, but, you know, the reality is, we're never going to defeat terrorism. I mean, terrorism is a strategy. You can't defeat a strategy. What we can do is to, through smarter solutions and more effective, creative solutions, we can reduce the risk associated with terrorism. One of the many myths about the so-called lone wolf terrorist is that this is a special kind of terrorism that we can never see coming. You know, and this is where the myth, the psychology of the lone wolf often gets its strength, the idea that, well, of all of the terrorists that are out there, the lone wolves are the ones we never see coming. Well, there was a study commissioned by the Department of Homeland Security in 2014, of which I was one of the co-authors, And we found that in about two-thirds to three-quarters of all the lone wolf cases that we looked at, there was a very significant amount of what we call behavioral leakage. In other words, friends, family members, and coworkers had a very clear sense that this person was about to, not just that this person had extremist beliefs, but they were actually about to commit an act of public violence. The issue for us then became, well, why are those concerns not reported? So this is a roundabout way of answering your question in terms of what we can do. I think one of the things we really, really have to do as a society is to figure out how to make it easier and more convenient for people to report suspicious behavior. So that, I'm sure you're familiar with the phrase, if you see something, say something.
Right.
The issue is not that things are not being seen, but not enough people are saying what they're seeing. And that's something we don't quite understand.
Now, is there at all a slippery slope associated with that where someone goes, oh, this guy is creeping me out or something like that, I'm going to report him? Maybe they're just going about their everyday lives and this is their...
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So again, whether it is direct military action or prevention efforts, I mean, there's always a slippery slope. And this is why, we need to be very, very careful in monitoring these cases. Where does an investigation turn into entrapment or vice versa? I mean, so that goes without saying. That's the territory we're in here. It doesn't, however, mean that we mustn't still strive to come up with meaningful and evidence-based solutions to curbing this problem.
And is it predominantly men who get involved in terrorism? It seems to be that way.
For the most part, it's angry, young, disenfranchised men in their early to mid-20s. I mean, that is the broad, crude demographic profile of who becomes involved in terrorism. Now, again, that will change. We've seen over the years that more and more women have become involved, have become mobilized. We've seen movements like the Islamic State have mobilized infants and children in a way that we really haven't seen before, at least in the non-state terrorism context. So you'll see the so-called profile will ebb and flow, not just across groups, but even within the same group over time. But for the most part, we're talking about young men.
Okay. And is that just because young men are more, tend to be more volatile or violent or anything like that?
It might be. I mean, it might be that. I mean, it might have to do with have to do with simple gender assumptions as well. I mean, even in cases where women get involved in terrorist groups, their roles typically tend to be relegated to support or ancillary roles. And even in groups that might portray women's involvement as being revolutionary and groundbreaking, it really is little more than tactical and strategic innovation, and it's far less to do with gender equality.
That's interesting. So maybe if they were more devoted to gender equality, they would bolster their recruits.
Possible.
So why do you think so many resources have gone, at least in the U.S., towards, or at least so much of the attention has gone towards Islamic terrorism when...
It will change. I mean, I think, to coin a phrase, we do need to be able to walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. I mean, make no mistake about it. I mean, the events of 9/11 marked a significant upswing in what we thought or assumed terrorist groups were capable of. And because those events were orchestrated and executed by an apparently religiously inspired group, Al-Qaeda, that really formed the hub of all of the focus and the attention in the years that followed. But terrorism comes and goes, and it takes different flavors and shades and orientation. It's not as if extreme right-wing terrorism has just come about in the last couple of years. It has always been there, but these waves, if you like, they fluctuate.
Okay. Yeah, because I mean, that's what I was gonna follow that up with. Is, I mean, it's at least in the U.S., it's predominantly extremist killings come from extreme right-wing folks.
Yeah, correct. And that might change too. I mean, it was only a few years ago when we were describing the Islamic State as a group that was so powerful that they were able to command global attention through these sadistic and extraordinarily well choreographed videos. And now they're largely derided as defeated in yesterday's group, which I think is premature, mind you. But the current wave of extreme right-wing terrorism will eventually abate, and it will be overtaken by somebody else or some other ideology, some other flavor, if you like. So these expressions of terrorism will find different opportunities depending on what's going on globally. It is, as someone who I would say I'm an observer of terrorism, a student of it. It is puzzling to me that we haven't seen a resurgence of climate-related terrorism, climate change-related terrorism, environmental terrorism in the way that one would expect given the monumental crisis we're facing globally right now. So it's one of those things that I think puzzles researchers and certainly puzzles onlookers. But the idea that we can only be focused on one kind of terrorism at a time, and the reality is very, very far removed from that.
I wanted to ask specifically about Islamic terrorism. There had been some study commissioned by MI6 that said that increasing religious devoutness was negatively correlated with likelihood of joining a terrorist group. Like a lot of the certain terrorists have been found with, Islam for Dummies. But there is a perception among some folks in the U.S. that Islam is the problem. To
I
what
think
extent?
it's a view that largely stems from ignorance. I mean, and that ignorance might sound like a very offensive term, but I mean that's largely what it is. And I mean there's an abundance of evidence to support that MI5 or MI6 study, whoever commissioned it. The overwhelming majority of Muslims will never become in anything violent, let alone something as dramatic and extreme as terrorism. But yet, we have these simplistic assumptions because we try to reverse engineer it, and we try to think, well, if you are a Muslim, you're somehow predisposed to becoming involved in violent action, and it's nonsense. I think at the heart of this is confusion about the relationship between radical views and radical action. And two things that we know from the research so far. The first is kind of what I just said, which is that the overwhelming majority of people will never become involved in terrorism. The overwhelming majority of people who hold radical views will never become involved in terrorism. I mean, I'm a fairly left-leaning academic. I view it as a healthy norm to have radical views about society and to want to bring about societal change. That I think that is a sign of a healthy democracy. What we're also finding from the research, however, is that those who actually become involved in terrorist action, so unambiguous violence against a targeted group of people, don't necessarily hold radical views. Like I said, they get involved initially for the reasons I gave earlier: adventure, excitement, a sense of purpose, wanting to belong to something that they come to believe is far bigger than them. And so we have these very simplistic assumptions about how people go down these pathways that the evidence really just doesn't bear out at all.
And I don't want to take up too much of your time, but before we wrap up here, how did you get involved in this? I mean, it's not a straightforward, thing that people start wanting to interview terrorists and stuff like that. It's very
It's true. That is true. I would love to say that there was a good story about it, but honestly, it was total accident. I mean, much like the stories of listening to stories about how people get involved in terrorism, I think it was about being at the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time. But as a psychology student, I was fortunate enough to have as one of my professors someone I eventually came to know was a terrorism expert and a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant professor, but very, very disorganized. And he would come to class completely unarmed to talk about anything else but terrorism. And so every principle that I would learn about psychology and how extreme behavior develops, he would teach through the lens of terrorism and terrorist examples. And so I was really struck by the idea that you don't have to be psychopathic or odd or unusual to become involved in terrorism. And I remember the first time I heard that idea, I was just blown away. Because, you know, like most people, I think I just assume that this is the product of irrational, warped, psychopathic minds. And the fact that the reality is far more disturbing and insidious. I mean, I think that kind of got under my skin, and I started being obsessed with that idea ever since. And I probably can't do anything else now, so I decided to stay with it. It's a fascinating area of study, and I just find myself continuously drawn back to it. I think we're still in the very, very, very early days of trying to make sense of it all. And, you know, I'm, as a member of the public, I'm just as hungry for answers to this problem as anyone else. And so, I'm trying to do my bit in terms of providing data and evidence that might hopefully help us rather than hinder us.
Well, you said you were from Ireland. Was the IRA at all a presence when you were growing up there, or?
Not where I was growing up, no. I mean, I'm happy to say that I was never affected by it. I mean, I was aware of it for sure, but I was never affected by, what is referred to in Ireland as the Troubles. Ireland is a very, very, very small country. And, it's only about 400 miles, give or take, from the bottom of the country to the south. It's a sign of just how much extraordinary conflict and violence was concentrated in a very, 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 very small part of the country. I was certainly aware of it, but I wasn't affected by it at all.
Okay. And lastly, what you said that we can't capture and kill our way out of terrorism. What sorts of solutions can we take?
I think we have to take prevention seriously, and we're not really doing that now. And I think there's an uncomfortable perception out there that when we talk about terrorism prevention and off ramps and things like that, that it sounds like we're being soft on terrorism. And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, I think it's high time that we had, and this is in an era where I think there is. Increasing dissatisfaction with science and evidence and facts, generally speaking. Terrorism is such a serious problem. And, terrorism will not end us. You know, we talk about, when we listen to politicians talk about terrorism, it's presented as if it's this existential threat that's going to end us all. It won't. It's not nearly as significant as some of the other problems in our society. That said, we need smarter solutions. We do need to take prevention seriously in a way that I just don't see any evidence for right now.
Well, Dr. Horgan, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you to Dr. John Horgan, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. See you next time.